Lecture 15, The Theory and Practice of the Mandala.
In the last lecture, we saw that the goal of tantric practice was to understand emptiness, to embody emptiness, to come to some kind of direct awareness of emptiness by achieving a union of opposites. This union was expressed by a series of symbolic pairs. We talked about the symbolic distinction between wisdom and compassion, male and female, and so on and so forth, all embodied, expressed, represented in various ways in tantric art and tantric symbolism. These pairs applied to the personality, to each individual person, to ritual action, to the tantric gestures and rituals that are used to embody these images and to understand their significance, and also to the cosmos as a whole. In this lecture, we're going to discuss a system of tantric symbolism that's based not on the number of two, not on the idea that you unify reality by unifying simply pairs of opposites, but on the number five, as expressed in the symbolism of the mandala. And as before, the goal is going to be to overcome duality by sewing the complex reality of human experience into a single unified whole. So the symbolism of the mandala is another important expression of the tantric tradition and a very common way in which people encounter tantric Buddhism in the practice of Buddhism. So let's start out with a basic question. What is a mandala and what does it express? The word mandala itself is a pretty simple word. It means simply a circle. So a mandala, as complex as it can often become when it's elaborated symbolically in tantric art, is basically a circle. In its most simple form, a mandala consists of five major points: north, south, east, and west, and then the point at the center. In tantric art, in tantric symbolism, and in tantric practice, a separate Buddha can be associated with each one of these points. These five Buddhas, the five Buddhas of the mandala, are known as meditation Buddhas or dhyani Buddhas, Buddhas who were often used in meditation and often, of course, expressed in the artistic representation of a mandala. The identity of these Buddhas is not fixed. It's one of the things that makes the study of the symbolism of a mandala so complex. Different Buddhas are often associated with different mandalas and different rituals, and Buddhas often change places in the mandala depending on the practice of the person who approaches the mandala or uses it for a specific purpose. But a Buddha who often occupies the center of a mandala is the Buddha Akshobhya. This is a Buddha we haven't encountered before. He's an important Buddha, particularly in the tantric tradition. His name means the unshakable. So Akshobhya Buddha is the Buddha who sits at the center of the mandala and is unshaken. He symbolizes consciousness, and he also symbolizes the element of space. Now, you could say, I think, when you encounter the mandala for the first time, that it's useful to think of it as functioning in a rather simple ritual way. It simply draws a line around some ritual space, demarcates it, and separates it from the profane space that lies outside. And then it suggests in some way that you can walk around this space, perhaps circumambulate its perimeter, and then encounter reality directly by moving right straight to the center of the mandala. So a mandala, you might say, draws a circle around space, and it suggests to us that the movement of our consciousness, perhaps the movement even of our physical journey, is to go around the mandala, encounter its diversity, and then unify reality by going right straight to the center. Now, the five Buddhas of the mandala help a person carry out this process of symbolic unification by being connected, by connecting themselves to other lists of five, We saw this occur also when we were talking about basic tantric symbolism that has to do with the unification of opposites. There are many different opposites that could be unified symbolically together. And the same is true in this system of sets of five. There are five Buddhas in the mandala. What else are there five of in the Buddhist tradition? Actually, I sometimes think that it would be fun to have a test for graduate students and ask them, in Buddhism, what is there one of, two of, three of, four of, five of, and see how high you can go in your classification of Buddhist lists. Fortunately, well, we did get up to the 12-fold chain of dependent origination not so long ago, and we talked about the eightfold path, but fortunately our numerology in Tantra stops at five, with the addition sometimes of a sixth. In any case, what are the five that we're talking about here? Well, there are five aggregates, the five constituents of the personality. We talked about that when we talked about no self. So each of these Buddhas is associated with one of the aggregates. That begins to suggest to us how these Buddhas function. There are five forms of consciousness in this tradition, five different ways of knowing that can be symbolized by each of the Buddhas and invoked in a certain way. And with the forms of consciousness, because this is a tantric tradition where wrath and serenity go side by side, there also are five unfavorable evil states of consciousness. They too are symbolized by the Buddhas in their wrathful manifestation. Each one has a different color. So there are five colors. There's a green Buddha and a blue Buddha and a white Buddha and a red Buddha, all of which you can map when you work your way through the mandala. Five directions of the cosmos, north, south, east, and west, and then, of course, the center, the place where that is the goal of your meditation. There are five female Buddhas, or yoginis, because each of these male figures is connected in some way with a female figure. Five bodhisattvas, five watches of the day, five times of the day that these Buddhas all symbolize, five seasons of the year, five components of the alphabet, and so on and so on. All sorts of different ways that these Buddhas can symbolically sew together different aspects of reality. Now, to give you a sense of what this looks like in a mandala, let me read a description of Akshobhya Buddha to you, the Buddha who sits at the center of some mandalas. And I say that I will describe this in some way to give you the look of the mandala, in part to use the tantric terminology itself. The tantric tradition is a strongly visual tradition. It has to do with seeing reality in a certain way, and yet, of course, it wouldn't be Buddhism if it didn't convey this to you by words. So often the tantric tradition uses words to try to paint a certain picture to you, to give you a visual sense of how the universe is constructed and unified in a certain way. So in this description of Akshobhya, the text tells us first that you should lay out the space for the mandala in front of you and make offerings that you would typically make in a situation of worship, offerings of incense and flowers and so on, and then engage in the practice of visualizing Akshobhya. Begin to see him sitting in the middle of this mandala. There in the center of the mandala, one envisions the syllable PUM in many colors. This is interesting. We talked about mantras last time as being important in the tantric tradition. When you're visualizing Akshobhya, the first thing that you visualize is not his feet or his shoulders or his head or something like that. You visualize that sound that's associated with him. It's like the seed syllable out of which you'll generate eventually this vision of Akshobhya. So you envision the syllable PUM in many colors. And this then turns into a fair eight-petaled lotus of many colors with the red syllable RUM at the center. I almost wish we could all sit down and just do this. It sounds kind of like fun. Anyway, this becomes a solar disk upon which is a dark blue HUM, whence arises Akshobhya with one face and two arms. in the cross-legged posture and making the earth-touching gesture, that earth-touching gesture that we associated with the Buddha's defeat of Mara and the unshakableness of his awakening or his practice that led to his awakening. His body exhibits the 32 major and 80 minor marks of perfection. I won't list these. You can imagine what they might be. Long ear lobes, a little tuft of hair right between his eyebrows. For it is the repository of the whole host of excellent qualities, the 10 powers, fearlessness, and the rest. His body has no apertures, flesh, or bone, for it is neither true nor false, like the pure light that's reflected in a mirror. He is black in color because he is permeated with great compassion, and his symbol is a black vajra, or thunderbolt, which embodies the five constituents of the pure absolute. This is a classic description of the process that visualizes a Akshobhya in the center of the mandala. Now, the text goes on to say that Akshobhya is associated with consciousness, anger, the middle of the day, knowledge, space, sound, and in the system of the alphabet, the cha series of consonants. Now, when you put all these symbolic associations together, not just for Akshobhya, but for all of the Buddhas, the mandala gives you what, in effect, is a symbolic map of all of reality. You have visualized in that mandala everything and connected it to all the aspects of reality that you can name, constituents of the personality, the time of the day, the time of the year, the directions of the cosmos. All of those things have been established in this visualized system of the mandala. In other words, to use language that we've used before in this course, the mandala serves as a mesocosm, a middle realm that unites the microcosm of the personality with the macrocosm of the external world. This union of microcosm and macrocosm is similar to the union that we talked about in the Hindu tradition, in the Upanishads, when we were beginning to discuss the shape of Indian religion. But it's much more complex and detailed than anything we saw in the Upanishads. For one thing, it represents a very precise view of the structure of the world. At the center of this world system, as it's visualized in the mandala, is a mountain. We haven't talked about this before. It's a sacred mountain that rises up in the center of the world. The name of this mountain is Mount Meru. And around this mountain, according to traditional Buddhist cosmology, are four continents that are like triangular-shaped geographical entities. In traditional Buddhist cosmology, our home, the place where we live, is the southernmost continent that's known as Jambudvipa or the Rose Apple Island. So we live on one of the four petals, as it were, or triangular shapes that extends out of the central mountain of the cosmos. It's Mount Meru. Now you can see that this cosmology, this vision of the world, corresponds roughly to the geography, as you would expect, of India. There are mountains in the north. Behind those, that initial range of mountains may very well be a mountain that's even higher than anything that we can see, Mount Meru, up there somewhere in the north, beyond the main range of the Himalayas. And then, of course, extending down from this mountainous region is the triangular shape of the Indian subcontinent. But one of the interesting things about this Indian vision of the world, it's found in Hinduism as well as in Buddhism, is that it's translatable and it can be rendered by some process of analogy in other spaces as well. One of the fascinating things to do when you visit Indonesia, actually, is to go to Bali, that Hindu and Buddhist island in Indonesia that still bears the marks in so many ways of tantric ritual, and see how the sacred geography has manifested itself in Balinese life. You can imagine, even if you haven't been to Bali, that it's an island, it's a volcanic island that has a large central volcano that's the most holy space on the island. And a lot of the ritual in Balinese Hinduism has to do with capturing and manipulating and processing the sacred water that flows out of that central volcano. Well, how is the sacred volcano understood? As a version of Mount Meru. So you have there this image, really, of what the world looks like. It's a central mountain that is, as it were, the abode of the gods. Out of that flows various sacred influences that then have to be captured and ritually appropriated by the priests and the specialists of the tradition. This view of the cosmos, the view of the cosmos that is expressed in the mandala, also involves a precise view of the human personality, because the body itself is made up of a mandala. You perhaps have heard of the chakras that in some aspects of the Hindu tradition and in Buddhism as well are understood as energy centers located along the spine. In traditional tantric physiology, there are six of these running from the base of the spine right up to the top of the head. Five of these represent the points on the mandala, and then the top, the sixth point, represents that transcendent space that transcends even the space that lies at the center of the mandala. So the mandala can represent the geographical structure of the cosmos. It can be drawn on the ground and used as a ritual space, and it also represents the personality, the energy centers in the body. You can see that it unites the world in powerful ways, symbolically. Now, if this is what a mandala is, and this is a glimpse at some of its symbolic significance, how is a mandala used in the tantric tradition? What do people do with this powerful symbolic form? Well, one thing that can be done is pretty simple. A lot of tantric ritual looks very complex, but really, in a fundamental way, it's actually less complex often than it might seem. One thing that you can do is to take a plate that's inscribed with the form of a mandala, or with the form of the geographical shape of the world, as I've just outlined it to you, and then take bits of grain, each one used to designate some important piece within this structure, place it on the plate as you do it, invoke whatever the object is or the reality or power is that it represents, and then take that and offer it to a deity. Well, simple gesture. You know, we could do that. If I had one of those plates, we could all gather around the podium and we could make that offering. It might take us a while to assemble all the different pieces and to designate them for ourselves, but it's not a complicated gesture. But what a powerful symbolic action. Because what you're doing there, really, is making an offering to the Buddha or to whatever object it is you're worshiping, the whole world. You're just putting it right out there. You're designating it, mapping it for yourself, and then making it as an offering to the Buddha. When I offer a flower, well, that's great, but that's just one small part of the cosmos. How much more powerful and how much more effective to be able to take some ritual form like this and create a map of the cosmos and offer it symbolically to the deity. That's one of the things you can do with a mandala. Another thing that is often done as a form of worship, but also as a way of meditating on all the different issues that a mandala represents, is to create a mandala using colored sand. When groups of Tibetan monks are asked to display some aspect of their tradition to American audience, especially to American audiences that are tuned in to the visual expression of Buddhism and are interested in knowing something about Buddhist art, they often create mandalas using colored sand, sometimes relatively simple mandalas, not terribly complex, and sometimes mandalas that are enormously complex that take weeks to put together grain by grain. These sand mandalas are blessed and function as temporary palaces for the deities of the mandala. When the worship is over, the mandalas are swept up and destroyed as a lesson in impermanence. Mandalas used for worship don't have to be just in two dimensions, because the cosmos that we're talking about here with Mount Meru at the center is also a three-dimensional structure in ways that you can imagine. So mandalas can be constructed and made as ritual spaces and as objects for worship in three dimensions as well. In Tibet, when I was traveling there a couple of years ago in the Potala Palace where the Dalai Lama lives, there are several enormous and complex three-dimensional mandalas that represent the cosmos and are used in various ways as ritual objects. But the most impressive three-dimensional mandala I've ever experienced myself is the mandala at the Kumbum, the great temple of the thousand Buddhas in Gyantse in Tibet. Really an extraordinary place. It used to be on the main trade route from Nepal into Lhasa, and now seems a little bit like a backwater, really, on the plateau, on the high Tibetan plateau. But one, I think, what I would say is one of the most impressive and extraordinary Buddhist monuments in the world. It's a large white structure with several levels of chapels that you can go into, circumambulate, walk around, and visit each one of these little chapels, paying homage, if you want, to the Buddha that resides therein, but also seeing in each one of the chapels a visual representation of the particular worship liturgy that has to be associated, that should be associated with each one of these mandalas. If you're understanding this course not just as an intellectual exploration of Buddhism, but maybe as a way of getting some hints about where you'd like to go in the world to try to see some Buddhism, I'd really strongly suggest that you go and see this extraordinary monument at Gyantse in southern Tibet. Along with Lhasa, it's one of the most impressive aspects of impressive manifestations of Tibetan culture. So these are all mandalas that can be used in one way or another as objects of worship or as places of worship. That's really the category that we're discussing. But obviously mandalas can be used as powerful tools for meditation. That's important too. In fact, all of our discussion of mandalas has really led us in that direction. In some rituals connected with the mandala, Tibetan practitioners visualize the deities that are found in this sacred space. And these visualizations often, as I suggested when we were talking about Akshobhya, are quite detailed and follow the form of the tantric deities as they're represented in the texts and in tantric art. Now, if you think about it, if you remember back a couple of lectures, perhaps two or three lectures ago, when we were talking about emptiness, I asked you to do a simple meditation with me in which we visualized a Buddha in front of us, a Buddha with a golden body, many rays coming out of the body at the end of each ray. There was another Buddha that it was glowing in its own way. And then I said that we should imagine that we were going to travel to, say, a flower market or travel for perhaps to all of the corners of the universe and gather together all of the flowers that we could wrap up in some imaginative way in our arms and present as offerings to this Buddha. I use that as an example of a meditation on emptiness, basic Mahayana practice that can be used to explore some of the ambiguities and the perplexities of the emptiness doctrine. But I also talked about that as a way of planting a seed that we could then nurture a little bit when we talk about tantric practice, because this is exactly what these tantric practitioners are doing. They're visualizing the deities of the mandala in front of them and making offerings to them that are meant to invoke their power and to make their energy present in the world. But they're doing something in this tradition that's a little different than what I described before. We still, when we were talking about this visualization, thought of the Buddha as being different from ourselves, as sitting out there in front of us as the object of our worship. In the tantric tradition, you dissolve the distinction between the Buddha and yourself. So at the end of this ritual, after this worship is done, when you've invoked, you've created the image of the Buddha, you've invoked its power and made it real in front of you, you dissolve that Buddha into your heart so that that Buddha becomes you and you become that Buddha. What more powerful way in a meditative experience of overcoming the duality between yourself and the Buddha? They sometimes say that the tantric tradition is a powerful way of achieving enlightenment very quickly. If not in this life, in just a few lifetimes. You can see from this ritual why that might be possible. Because you're using ritual and you're using various kinds of symbolic forms to imagine the Buddha in front of you and then dissolve yourself into the Buddha and the Buddha into you. You become the Buddha and he becomes you. This is sometimes called in the tantric tradition deity yoga, a discipline in which you imagine the deity in front of you and then you become identified with it. It's one of the fundamental forms of practice in the tradition of the mandala. Now, there's another way that the mandala can be used in Buddhist practice that's fascinating to explore. We won't have enough time to go into it in as much detail as it really deserves. But in the book called The Tibetan Book of the Dead, it's used as a ritual in funerals to help guide the soul of a dead person through the difficulties of the afterlife and also, of course, to provide a meditation for the living about what will happen to them when they die. The movement of the soul, or the movement of consciousness to be more precise, through the afterlife is visualized as a journey through the mandala. Not from the edges to the center, as we were talking about before, but from the center out to the edge. When a person dies, according to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, the consciousness becomes dissolved into the form of the central Buddha in the mandala, in a state of pure non-dual awareness. And if through all the meditation that the person has done before the moment of death, if that person can recognize that and accept it and become absorbed into it, then the person is no longer subject to rebirth. But if there's something frightening about that experience, the person recoils from it and can't stay absorbed in that terrifying white light, then he begins to fall out of the center of the mandala and make a procession around the edge, seeing each one of the deities of the mandala on a different day. And then, of course, when that's over, seeing all of those deities again in their wrathful form. At each moment on this process, it's possible to become absorbed into that deity and to escape the cycle of transmigration, if that's something the person has prepared for. If not, eventually the person falls off the edge of the mandala and back into rebirth in this world. So the mandala is used, at least in this tradition, as a way, shall we say, of visualizing the movement through the afterlife and giving some kind of ritual form to the guidance that people give to the spirits of the dead. And then finally, I'll just mention one more important way that the mandala manifests itself in Buddhist practice, a way that you yourselves might someday encounter in your travels. I said before that the mandala can represent the cosmos as a whole. But it doesn't have to represent all of the cosmos. It can be mapped simply onto a particular piece of land. Tibet itself is understood as a mandala with a sacred center in the capital city of Lhasa. So one way of experiencing the mandala in Tibet is to go on a pilgrimage, to circumambulate the great country itself, visiting the shrines that mark all of these sacred spots on the mandala, and then finally making your way into that central territory that is associated with the capital city, and then within the capital city with the central shrine right in the center of Tibet. The shrine is called the Jokhang and holds the most sacred image in Tibetan Buddhism. You find as you make your way through these pilgrimage sites that there are always two important elements. There always is a circumambulation, a movement around, visiting of different sacred spots along the perimeter of whatever manifestation of the mandala it is that you're encountering, and then there's this movement into the center where you encounter some kind of symbolic representation of reality in its unified state. So you can see that the mandala is, in a lot of ways, quite a simple form. It really is just a circle, you know. It's just a way of drawing a line around the world and indicating that at the center of that circle, we might encounter reality in some more powerful or more direct way than we would in our ordinary experience. But it is extraordinarily malleable and translatable, and it affects many aspects of Buddhist life, all of which would be fascinating, I would have to say, to explore in much more detail than we're able to do in just this one lecture.